Okay, moral status, as has already been pointed out a couple of times this morning, starts off as a matter of self-interest. So it starts off with the easy proposition that we matter. And then, of course, the problem becomes, how do we define the we? So our self-interest as humans encourages us to start from the assumption that humans matter, and it's a common intuition that humans matter more. So what might be called, indeed what has been called by some present company included, folk psychology accounts of moral status rely on species boundaries. So humans have moral status, most other species don't. Humans, yes, and non-humans, no or less. This may be a sensible heuristic in everyday life, since the chances are that many of the humans we will meet will have full moral status, and also that we'll encounter few beings with full moral status who are not human. But as we well know, and is often the case with everyday heuristics, it turns out on closer scrutiny to be philosophically problematic. So while both self-interest and our everyday intuition suggest there's something special about being human, various analyses, including, again, by those here today, have demonstrated that basing moral status on biological species membership is philosophically difficult to justify. And that's both because biological species is a contested concept in itself, so there's no clear single definition of what's a biological species. Creatures exist that are between species, that cross the boundaries. And, of course, if we say that human species membership is necessary and sufficient, we are open to the charge of speciesism. So there's no sound reason for according the biological property of species membership any moral significance. In the context of contemporary bioethics, new knowledges and emerging technologies that propose to disrupt the conventional categories, processes, and boundaries of biology have prompted us to revisit the question of species and moral status on several fronts. So our thinking about species and moral status is being challenged in new ways. Firstly, we're able to disrupt species boundaries, not just philosophically, but biologically. The creation of interspecies chimeras in disrupting the human-non-human species boundary forces us also to go beyond species boundaries in considering the moral status of the new beings created. Second, we now have a greater understanding of the biology underlying the cognitive and psychological capacities that, on at least some accounts, give rise to moral status. This also enables us potentially to manipulate these capacities with the congruent possibility that this might lead to enhanced moral status. So this may lead to members of existing biological species having new moral properties, or even to the creation of new moral species, so what we might call a moral species transition. And the subjects of this moral status enhancement need not be human, though of course they might be. So we might think, for example, of cognitively enhanced animals, super chimps, or as Walter said, super bonobos might be better, or of creating post-humans or post-persons. Now, if biological species membership is unimportant when it comes to moral status, then we might say that biological species transitions are irrelevant in terms of whether or not they alter moral status. And that being the case, you might think that this would be a very short paper. I could just stop there. But I do think that thinking about species transitions, species boundaries, both biological and moral, can prompt us to useful approaches for our considerations, for our rethinking of moral status. And that's what I propose to do in the rest of what will not be such a short paper. To do this, I need to begin by setting out a few issues in how we think about moral status. And I particularly thank the previous two speakers for having brought up a number of points which I think frame this discussion well. So when we ask the question about moral status, we're asking what it is to matter morally for one's own sake. I align with David in thinking that the possession of interests is a basis for moral considerability. And this, of course, implies having certain capacities that give rise to those interests. So this account is one both about interests and about psychological capacities that ground them. But is relative moral status, so when we start to think of whether beings can have more or less moral status, is relative moral status about what interests a being has or what we owe to a being in view of its interests? So again, I'm taking as read that in order to have any kind of moral status, a being has to have morally considerable interests in the first place. So now I'm asking a question that deals with degrees of moral status, if there can be such a thing. Similarly, I'm talking here of interests and obligations. I haven't phrased the question in the language of rights, but the same question could be asked in terms of what rights a being has. Okay, so to illustrate the difference that I'm trying to tease out here, let's say we have two beings, A and B, and they have sets of interests, interests of A, interests of B. If the interests of A are equal and identical in all respects to the interests of B, does that mean that A and B have the same moral status? Or could we say that if A has a higher moral status than B, our obligations to satisfy the interests of A, or a subset of A's interests, are greater than our obligations to satisfy the interests of B, or a like subset of B's interests? So in other words, is moral status about what interests there are and what obligations we owe? Or can we say moral status is based on something else, and therefore our obligations in respect of the interests that beings of different moral status have will be different, even though the interests or the interest is the same? So are we saying that if the moral status of A is more than B, the interests of A somehow count more than the interests of B for any interest that they share equally? Okay, and this is assuming as well that we have no special responsibilities towards A or B, so we have no special relationships, nothing like Liz's cats. Would A having a higher moral status justify or require us to place the satisfaction of A's interest above that of B? Okay, I'm not actually going to answer the question, but I think in asking it, it frames some interesting points about the way that we're trying to relate interests, obligations, maybe rights, and moral status. Do variable interests or variable rights lead to variable moral status? Clearly, they're likely to ground different obligations, but does that actually mean different moral status? And I think this was a claim that was starting to emerge, Walter, from some of what you were saying, that having different sets of rights might actually mean a different moral status. Imposing the question in the first place, we have a problem of commensurability and of separability of interests. So what might or could it mean to state that, for example, a mouse or a supermouse and a human have the same interest in continued life? I don't think that we necessarily do, but if we were to try and make that claim, A and B have the same interest in something, how can we measure that? Regarding separability, can a single interest in, say, the continuation of one's life be disentangled from the contingent interests that we have in all the things that we might do with our lives once continued? There's further an evidentiary and epistemic problem with respect to interests and the strength thereof, in that if I claim I have as strong an interest in continued life as you do, how do we know that's true? How can we judge this? Okay, I'm not going to attempt here to produce a definitive account of moral status, because that is the job of this entire conference, and many better minds have attempted it. But let me say some things about a general account of moral status that we might start to use to think about species transitions and moral status enhancement. So moral status is, I think, related to interests. It's based on capacities. It should be species neutral. I also think that the argument for equal consequential consideration that's been put forward is one that applies here. And there are, to me, it's plausible to subscribe at least to some elements of what Kagan has called unitarianism, which means we have, so this is in counterposition to the claim that variable rights or interests give rise to variable status, we have a moral status which is the right to have our interests taken into consideration, and then what we are owed will vary depending on those interests, but we all have, at heart, the right to have our interests taken into consideration. Okay, so if we think that's the case, of course, starting to talk about moral status enhancements perhaps doesn't really make sense, because if we're going to say we all have one and it's the same, how can you enhance it? So please bear in mind that throughout this discussion, I am treating both moral status and the idea of full moral status as what I call problem concepts. That is, I'm going to use them, but I'm not going to use them uncritically. I'm going to use them in ways that they have been thought about to try and show ways that we need to rethink them. So I hope that makes sense. Okay, some further problems in connecting moral status and interests is that obviously moral status is not just the sum of our interests, or at least I don't think it can be. And not all interests seem to be relevant to moral status. So, for example, if I acquire a bicycle, I also acquire an interest in owning a bicycle pump. But it doesn't seem to me that my moral status in that more Unitarian sense is increased thereby. I'm not sure how vital it is actually to try and disentangle moral status from interests or to understand exactly how they relate to each other. And the reason for that is, given that the main reason we want to understand what moral status a being has, at least in a practical sense, is to know how we should treat it, perhaps it doesn't matter. So if you consider cases of morally justifiable assisted dying, in which a being that you consider to be a person or to have full moral status, ordinarily a kind of being it would be wrong to kill, if that being, all things considered, no longer has an interest in continued life, most of us wouldn't want to say that person has less moral status, but if the upshot of our analysis is that killing this being might after all be permissible, how much does the moral status question matter? So I'm going to put aside exactly how much we need to dig that out. I think that's a question less practical than theoretical. All the same, it does seem that there are certain sorts of critical interests, critical life interests, that are more relevant to moral status than others, and we've seen a few of them already identified today. So these result in common thresholds in views where we have degrees of moral status, one being sentience, another being personhood or full moral status. And I understand by this that personhood is just a shorthand. Personhood is a useful term that we like to apply when what we mean is full moral status. What do we mean when we speak of full moral status? I'm going to return to this problem of fullness later, but for now I'll just use it synonymously, in which some philosophers have treated as personhood. So when we speak of full moral status, we tend to mean a bundle of moral rights. So the most common one is not to be killed, but also rights to self-determination, not to be used instrumentally, etc. And that's grounded, as David, I think, convincingly argued, in the idea of a narrative life, a respect. When we talk about respect for life, we mean not just a being's aliveness, but having a life as a coherent whole. So this relates in some ways to Regan's idea of the experiencing subject of a life, but it's more than just experience. It is the narrative, what makes that life into a whole, and is therefore related to what gives the individual, related to questions about identity. So what it is that makes a life a coherent whole is, on some accounts at least, and in one sense of the term, what gives an individual living that life a coherent identity. And this has implications then for how we think about potential moral status enhancements. Okay, so let's consider now some types of what might be commonly thought of as moral status enhancement. I'm not claiming that they all are, and in fact I'm going to go on later and say that some of these are not, but when we think about the kinds of enhancement technologies, chimerization, etc., the kinds of things that we're saying this might result in increased moral status, here are the sorts of things we think about. Human, non-human chimeras. So we had the idea that prompted the first big discussion in bioethics of human, non-human chimeras was the still mythical human neuron mouse, which didn't get made in that form in the end. More recently, we have seen human mouse neural chimeras, not with neurons per se, but with other brain cells, which do appear to be smarter or have increased cognitive capacities. We are also seeing the creation of human-pig chimeras via the process of blastocyst complementation, so it's being suggested that these chimeras might make good hosts for growing human organs. But actually, if you put in pluripotent cells at the blastocyst stage, there is a chance that they're going to go into nerve tissue or brain tissue and somehow confer increased cognitive capacities. So this has not been demonstrated so far, but it's a possibility. We have the possibility of animal enhancement. So, for example, as yet mythical super chimp, a chimpanzee or a bonobo who is enhanced cognitively to the point where they would have intelligence equivalent to a normal adult human. In the real world, we are seeing experiments that try to make non-human primates more like humans. So there was a recent paper that came out about monkeys that had genome editing in the cells of their brain so as to make them a little bit more human. Now, none of these creatures have so far demonstrated that they have anything like human capacities or human intelligence, but nevertheless, in crossing those boundaries, they prompt us to reconsider the questions. Human to post-human or post-person enhancement is, of course, another moral status enhancement that's been quite extensively discussed. And then the fourth example is the development of sophisticated AI. So right now our computers don't have moral status. If AI became sophisticated enough, they might acquire it, and that would be perhaps a form of moral status enhancement. to put those in context and think about what sorts of obligations we might have and whether we should do these things, let's think of some more everyday moral status enhancements. So, of course, the normal process of human development and upbringing is a form of moral status enhancement. If we think that a normal, adult, grown human being with a complex network of social relationships, with highly developed cognitive capacities, with a sense of moral agency, etc., has a higher moral status in some ways than a newborn infant. And we might not all think that, but on some accounts that is true. The process of going from the infant to the adult human is itself a moral status enhancement. Repairing a catastrophic brain injury that has resulted in a harm to psychological capacities and that might, on some accounts at least, cause one to become a non-person or to lose full moral status could be counted as a moral status enhancement, or perhaps alternatively moral status therapy. In that same category, we would probably put treating or curing a brain disease that would prevent an infant child from developing normal capacities. So all of these are moral status or putative moral status enhancements that we're a little bit more familiar with, that we see in everyday life. Okay, there are some conceptual issues, of course, when it comes to moral status enhancement. So in terms of human, non-human chimeras and whether these constitute a moral status enhancement, we have what I call the species identity problem. So would a pig-human chimera that had intermediate capacities and perhaps an intermediate moral status on that basis be an enhanced pig or a dehanced human? So is this a moral status enhancement, or is it a moral status dehancement, or is it in fact something else entirely? Numerous people have written about human enhancement. One of my favourite quotes is from John Harris, who says, if it wasn't good for you, it wouldn't be enhancement. So we need also to ask whether moral status enhancement is good for us. And there's what I then think of as the animal identity problem, good for whom? So in the process of creating a human, non-human chimera, is chimerization a form of enhancement at all, or is it actually creation or recreation? And I would say it's actually the latter. So you have not enhanced anything, you have created a being that happens to have certain moral capacities. Once that being exists, it can be enhanced or dehanced, but the process of creation itself is neither an enhancement nor a dehancement. So actually it turns out that of the various moral status enhancements that I listed on the previous slide, not all of them are actually moral status enhancements. Creating a morally significant being de novo is neither an enhancement nor a dehancement, although we might have moral reasons to do it or not to do it, but not based on that being's own interests. So there's no obligation to create in view of the being who will be created. We might also think that some of what I talked about as moral status enhancements actually constitutes such a severe disruption to identity that it's the equivalent of creating a morally significant being de novo. So Michael Tooley, in his famous paper, Abortion and Infanticide, proposes the idea of a personhood potion that you could apply to kittens that would give them the potential to eventually turn into persons. If we could turn not just kittens, but all sorts of other things, so maybe chimpanzees, but maybe also fruit flies into persons. What about inanimate objects such as chairs or laptop computers? If we could apply the potion to these and give them the potential to develop into persons, into beings with supposedly full moral status, ought we to do this? And I think in cases where what would result is such a significant disruption of identity, or indeed the creation of a new identity, the intelligent chair, there is no reason for us to do it. So do we then have any obligations to moral status enhancement? Should we attempt to enhance the moral status of other beings? So the question of what sorts of beings should have moral status pertains not just to our theories about what properties are required for moral status and therefore what kinds of beings should be accorded moral status. It also applies to the question of whether we should attempt directly to confer moral status on or increase the moral status of other beings by altering their properties. So I said on the previous slide that there is no obligation in view of a future being's interest to create that being de novo. So I've said here, and I realise I'm going to slightly give the lie to this later on, it's not only if there's an existing interest, but in terms of the being that is to be enhanced, if that being has an interest in a moral status enhancement, then we might have a moral reason to do it. That's not the only case in which we might have obligations, but what matters is that the being itself has an interest. What does it mean to have an interest in increased moral status? Does an individual have an interest in increased moral status in itself? Well, if higher moral status means a right to better treatment, if it means a stronger claim that a given interest be satisfied, if higher moral status, in short, means more chance of having one's interests fulfilled, then it seems that moral status enhancement might well be an interest in itself. But that's like being given a ticket to more fulfilment, more rights, etc. We might also, however, ask whether a given individual has an interest in acquiring or having enhanced a certain property that would incidentally confer increased moral status. So in this case, the obligation would be not to moral status enhancement in and of itself, but to the fulfilment of a separate interest. So for example, I have an interest in becoming smarter, in becoming more morally capable, a better philosopher, etc. If in having that interest in becoming more cognitively able fulfilled, my moral status became incidentally enhanced, we might also say there's an obligation to do it, but not because it's a moral status enhancement, because there's an interest in the increase in the capacity itself. Okay, there are various problems still in trying to assess what a being's interests might be towards the enhancement of cognitive capacities or towards moral status enhancement. One of those, of course, is whether we consider just a being's interests at a particular time in that slice of its life, or do we consider the interests of a being across the narrative course of its life? How can we assess this when what the narrative course of a life is itself will be changed depending on whether and which interests are fulfilled? So that's a problem I'm going to leave for someone else to think about it, but I wanted to flag it. Is it the case then that expanded interests lead to greater moral status? And here is where, again, I'm using the term moral status here problematically, because I'm not sure that all expanded interests, or perhaps even any expanded interests, will necessarily confer greater moral status. But nevertheless, let's proceed. Having an expanded range of interests might actually be a problem, because it might result in more opportunities for one's interests to be frustrated. So we might ask, and indeed I think Steve asked me at one point many years ago, can it be good for one to acquire an ever-increasing range of interests that will not be satisfied? So can we say if a human pig chimera has more interests than a pig, could we echo Mill and say, is it better to be a human pig chimera dissatisfied than a pig satisfied? I think most of us would not say it's not good for human children to acquire the ever-expanding range of interests that they acquire in the process of their normal development and putative moral status enhancement, even though not all of those interests will be fulfilled. Nevertheless, some have argued that this non-fulfillment of interests, not being treated with respect due one's moral status, might be a reason not to enhance moral status or not to enhance interests. So with respect specifically to chimeras, for example, Strife has argued that if human, non-human chimeras are created and have a higher moral status than non-human animals, the subsequent treatment of the subject likely will fall far below what its new moral status demands. So in his view, in other words, the fact that you would have an increased moral status and not be treated accordingly, more of your interests would be frustrated, that's a reason not to create such beings. I don't think this argument entirely holds water. I think what this provides us with is a reason that we ought to treat beings commensurately with their moral status, whatever that happens to be, rather than failing to enhance them in order to ensure that beings have less capacity to be wrong. And two quick examples to illustrate this. If your employer treats you unfairly, that's not a reason to say you shouldn't have the job. You shouldn't have the job in the first place. That's a reason to say let's ensure better work conditions. If I suffer aforementioned type of catastrophic brain injury, I become maybe temporarily or contingently a non-person. If I am to be restored to full moral status, restored to personhood by treatment of that injury, it's fairly likely that at some point in my life someone's not going to treat me with respect for my full moral status. But again, that's not a reason to say don't treat the injury. Okay. Something else we might want to consider is what I call incidental species transitions. So what if a moral status enhancement would incidentally produce a species transition? We talked previously about augmenting capacities in a being's interest that would incidentally produce moral status enhancement. What if moral status enhancement would happen to produce a species transition? Nick Agar has argued with respect to the prospect of radical post-human enhancement that we might have an interest in remaining human rather than becoming post-human. So he said their values would not be ours, they would not be us. So he seemed to propose here that there may be an interest in either being of a particular species, biological species, or remaining so. In claiming that they would not be us, I think what's at the heart of this is perhaps the idea that this itself would be an identity-disrupting intervention such that it would constitute the creation of a new being who would not be us, a disruption to either narrative or psychological identity. Okay. So I said I would come back to the fullness of full moral status and why this is potentially problematic. The idea of full moral status implies that there's nothing beyond this. Full is full, right? You can't put any more water in the glass once the glass is full. So you can't have more than full moral status without making full moral status itself less than full. So the concept that post-persons might have more than full moral status is problematic. We think, and I tried to get graphs put up here and my ingenuity failed me, but we think of moral status in a number of different ways. It's been proposed that it's continuous, it's been proposed that it can be continuous up to a threshold, which is usually taken to be full moral status. When we think of post-persons, we then think that it's going to go up either continuously or discontinuously to a level beyond that. We might think that it's hierarchical, so stepped in various ways. What does it mean if there are thresholds? So I suggested there might be sentience being one, narrative identity and personhood being another. If there are hierarchical thresholds of moral status, what does it mean to be in the box, and how do we reconcile that with the differing interests, etc., that beings may have within those? So having thought about this, I actually have come to the conclusion that full moral status as we conceive of it is something of a furphy. So it's a kind of convenient fiction. I think the concept itself, and personhood as well, has emerged partly from our bioethical obsession with life and death. So the right to life, the right not to be killed, personhood, the value of life, etc. And this is understandable when you consider the kind of topics against which we've been honing our bioethical steel all these years. It's understandable also because, I said at the beginning, moral status is self-interested. We've been practicing an ethics of exclusion, where we go about defining what moral status is and who has it by thinking about what it's not and who doesn't have it. So, of course, on this account, most humans would have full moral status. And the idea of quantized moral status and the idea of the threshold beyond which we're all equal also plays very nicely with the political fiction that all ordinary humans are morally equal. They should be, but they are not treated as such. So it's a way, I think, of dealing with those problems of evidence that I mentioned earlier, the problems of separability, commensurability, evidence, etc., in being able to assess exactly what a being's interests are. We put everybody in a box and say, we can't judge whether my interest in life is stronger than yours, so let's say we are all equal in that sense. So it's a kind of combination of practical realism and giving beings the benefit of the doubt. Now, how does that fit with post-persons? Well, if beings have an interest in their continued lives, respect for their moral status requires that they recognise the value to them of those lives, the strength of that interest may vary, and full moral status lets us go all in one convenient box. Post-persons might be much more strongly connected to their future selves and thus have a stronger interest in the continued life of that future self. So I think, again, this was, in David, in your paper where you talked about about homogeneous, who has much stronger connections with their past and future selves, etc. So in that case, perhaps they would have more of a claim to have their lives continued. They might have interests we can't even yet imagine. I wonder as well whether post-person enhancement could alter interests in a way that we might consider a diminishment of moral status, at least on the ways we currently understand moral status in relation to a right to life. So imagine, for example, if post-persons are such sophisticated philosophers that they develop a different understanding of the importance of individual personal identity, such that they place much less value on their continued individual existence. They might actually have less strong interests in individual continued life, and therefore less of a right to have that life prolonged. Okay, the last area that we'll need to start thinking about is what sorts of moral agents we might be creating and what sorts of obligations they may have. So moral status enhancement might give these new beings an increased capacity for moral agency, meaning they can be the bearers of moral obligations. Now, I know there are arguments surrounding, and we've had, again, some of these discussions just this morning about to what extent moral agency and moral status are connected. But let's take that they may become moral agents and therefore have moral obligations. What kinds of obligations might chimeras or superchimps have? Let's think first that human, non-human chimeras will almost certainly, and in the first place, be created as experimental subjects. Again, this has been raised as a reason not to create them. Why should we create them when they will be instantly instrumentalized? I don't think this is necessarily a problem. So research is compatible with respect. And I draw an analogy here with the case of genome-edited babies and indeed other beings who are created as a result of new experimental technologies. They are committing themselves to being researched for the rest of their lives. They're going to be watched. Think about Louise Brown, perpetually a research subject for the development of IVF. But of course, in these days of big data, etc., we are all experimental subjects. Philosophers have argued that we have a duty to be experimental subjects. And chimeras and other morally enhanced beings, because of the way in which they've been created, may have a particular moral obligation to serve as research participants. Another way in which they might be useful is to serve as experimental moral subjects. So here I mean that creating human, non-human chimeras or enhanced animals in prompting us to think through these very questions about species and moral status could actually pave the way for better treatment of other animals. So I've said elsewhere that if we were to create what I think of as a sacrificial super chimp, who might not be treated with respect, the full respect due her moral status, but might prompt a rethinking of moral status such that we then treat many, many other animals better, then that would be a good thing to do. And so that leads to the final sort of point, which is that we may have reasons to create moral status-enhanced beings, be they chimeras, animals, or post-persons, not only in their own interests, but in the interests of others. So if we were to create post-persons who are better moral agents, better moral philosophers, they might help us sort out this moral status problem. It might be good for us, whoever us is. Now, people have said it might be bad for us because they would treat humans worse, but I would say that's because we've got the wrong idea of who us is. So if non-human animals are treated much better under a post-person morality, then that's probably a good thing. And so in crossing both moral and biological species boundaries, and a nod here, of course, to Francois and Jason's work, yes, it may cause confusion, but I think it should be a productive confusion that offers us the opportunity to become unconfused or less confused. I want to close with one last word on expanded interests. So the problem of ever-expanding interests, John Harris and I wrote a paper enough years ago that I've forgotten what year it was, on the problem of expanding interests, entitled whimsically, Does a Fish Need a Bicycle? And our argument in there was that if there were interests that could be fulfilled sequentially to the point where a fish might grow legs and need a bicycle, well, eventually, yes, it might. I'm still not sure whether a fish right now needs a bicycle, but I am always in search of good pictures to illustrate talks about human-animal hybrids, and I was delighted to find that in the foyer of our hotel, so those of you who are staying in the Mercure, there are all sorts of humanized animal photos on the walls. A fish may not need a bicycle, but I think a fox clearly needs a penny farthing. So thank you very much.